From TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing and say things to you on the radio instead. Joining me in the studio is Observer Associate Editor Forrest Wilder, who's been wearing a new hat about the office and really throwing everyone off. Hello, Forrest.
Hey, how's it going? You like my hat?
I mean, it's an improvement.
I wouldn't say I like it.
I'm not really a sports fan, Forrest. You know this about me.
Okay.
Also with us is Observer staff writer Patrick Michaels, who is currently hatless. Welcome, Patrick.
Hi, thanks.
Later in the show, Maury Shema will join us via phone to recount the gripping tale of a group of friends accused of child abuse 20 years ago who have spent that time since fighting for their freedom. They are known as the San Antonio Four. But first, we've got news to discuss. Patrick, the first question is to you. What is a healthcare navigator?
Well, that's a question that Texas is trying to figure out right now, too. So it's an apt question. As you may have noticed by the crumbling of our social institutions and life as we know it, Obamacare is in full effect.
Right, right.
And healthcare navigators are the folks who are charged with helping people sign up for health insurance who don't have insurance right now. So there are a number of groups in Texas that have gotten $11 million from the federal government to train navigators and you know, hire them to send them out and get people signed up for insurance. Texas is one of about 17 states, I think, that you know, sees what the federal rules are for what these navigators have to have as far as training and qualifications, and have said, well, that's not enough for our folks. We want something a little bit stiffer for training and qualifications.
And part of this is for, like, security purposes?
Well, that was the way that Rick Perry had sort of couched it in his letter to the insurance, to the Texas Department of Insurance, who are the ones making these rules now. He said, you know, we're going to have all these folks getting precious personal information, like social security numbers and your, you know, how much you make for a living, and maybe your health details you're going to put in this application. And we can't have just anybody. Any Tom, Dick, and Jane off the street, you know, getting all his information,
right,
because God knows, you know, where they'll send it. So the state of Texas is so good at protecting our personal data, as the comptroller's office showed a few years ago, right? That he wanted to have the insurance department set up its own training and guidelines for people who are going to handle this stuff, background checks for navigators. Greg Abbott, who's running for governor, also said something similar, that, you know, we need some tighter restrictions on who's going to do this. A lot of groups that were interested in sort of getting a lot of people insured really quickly, and Democrats who are supporting Obamacare say that it's just a roadblock, that all these rules are just a roadblock to, you know, to make it look like the program isn't doing very well, to keep people from getting signed up. But the story that we ran this week is about another sort of angle on this, on these new rules, which in Texas would add 40 hours of training for navigators who want to do this stuff, on top of the 20 to 30 hours that they already have from the federal government. They're going to need 40 more hours of training just on Texas specific rules and other things that,
right,
you know, the state says aren't covered. And so that's a lot more than any other state is requiring. Most states that do have more training required is like 10 hours more, you know. And there'd have to be companies that handle this training. So it's going to be $200 to $800 per navigator to get trained. And then you're going to pay a little bit more for testing as well once you get that training, just so you can be qualified by the state. And all that money is going to go probably to some private companies. The testing is likely... and this isn't a sure thing at all, but, you know, Pearson handles testing for other tests in the insurance department.
Who's Pearson?
So Pearson, thanks for asking, Forrest. You know, you may know Pearson from the STAR test that you get in your public schools.
Mm-hmm.
All of Texas,
mm-hmm,
standardized testing is developed by Pearson, and they handle grading the tests and turning that stuff around to the schools. They also are a publisher of textbooks, and they're just a giant corporation. They're based in London, and they do all kinds of stuff. They have all kinds of arms, and one of them is this sort of corporate testing business they have called Pearson VUE. And in other states, Pearson VUE has been the one that's testing navigators on the local rules. So basically, what has a lot of healthcare advocates in Texas upset is that there would be this, you know, amount of money that Texas is saying you have to spend now on navigators that's up to $800 a test, you know, plus other fees. It's almost $1,000. It's like $900 or $1,000 per navigator, just created by these new rules that these nonprofits have to spend to do this job that they've already got like a set amount of money from. What they're saying is that, in effect, you'd be taking money that was meant from the federal government. It was meant to get people insured, and you'd be kind of steering it away from that and giving it to, you know, the private sector. And so that's what has a lot of people, at least Democrats and some healthcare groups, upset.
It's kind of unusual for the Perry administration to go out of its way to create new red tape, right?
Yeah.
But then on top of that, the fear is that the concern is that the money is going to be incidentally or coincidentally routed to companies, and in particular maybe Pearson, who have already very lucrative and very tight kind of relationships with parts of state government.
I don't think you can say that the rules are being written in such a way that like it's deliberately meant to give Pearson in particular all kinds of money. It's just that they're the company that gets this business from Texas and from other states. They're the ones that handle this kind of thing. And so when you create these kind of rules, they're the ones who are going to be getting the money.
And from there, we go to a story that Forrest has been following. I think we need a hashtag for this story. Maybe payday loan gate.
Yeah.
Maybe we should stop using gate.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I like the word kerfuffle.
Kerfuffle is good.
I don't know what it means, but it's got enough syllables to sound fancy, and I like fancy.
Well, what's the latest stage in the kerfuffle?
Well, this all started around the end of the 2013, beginning of 2014. An El Paso Times reporter went to a hearing, I'm sure it was fascinating, of the Texas Finance Commission, an obscure agency, and talked to...
I hadn't watched that video yet. I had it queued up.
and an obscure agency, no one really heard much about it, and talked to the chairman of this agency, a guy named William White, of whom the public generally knew very little.
Oh, Bill White.
Right. Well, not Bill White, former mayor of Houston, former gubernatorial candidate. This is a different William White. This gentleman is an executive with Cash America, which is one of the big payday loan and pawn type chains. They've got stores, a bunch of stores in Texas, stores around the nation. And so the reporter with the El Paso Times went there to basically just do an interview because the guy wouldn't call him back on the phone. And White ended up making some very disparaging comments, I think it's safe to say, about payday loan customers, which is kind of odd. You normally don't talk trash about your customers, but
that's
kind of what he ended up doing.
What did he say?
Well, a number of things. I think the one that was kind of the big headline generator maybe is he suggested that people take out payday loans so they can buy 60-inch TVs rather than working folks trying to make ends meet in between paycheck to paycheck.
Sort of the welfare queen argument, but coming from a really surprising place.
Right. And he also said something to the effect, and I'm not quoting here, I'm paraphrasing, that, people make decisions, people make choices, and this is in the context of a question of do payday loans hurt poor people. People make choices, people make decisions, I make decisions, you make decisions, and we have to live with the consequences. And for folks who don't know, Texas is kind of the Wild West of payday loans. There's no limits on the interest rates, and so frequently you see APRs of 500% is very common. And so research suggests that, and reality suggests that people get stuck in a sort of a debt trap. With auto title loans, folks can have their cars repoed. Payday loan debt, payday loans, people can spend thousands of dollars on what was initially just a few $100 loan, just making payments on it. The whole thing, the kerfuffle around William White's remarks has kind of spilled over into the governor's race. Wendy Davis, who's been a long time a proponent of reforming and regulating payday loans in the state of Texas, basically came out blasting William White as a serious conflict of interest. I mean, here's the guy who's the chairman of the Texas Finance Commission, which oversees, if I didn't mention before, by the way, oversees payday loans, who's also an executive with one of the largest chains of payday loan places in the country. Trying to put her opponent, Greg Abbott, Texas Attorney General, on the spot. There was kind of radio silence from him for a while.
The reasoning being that he would either support the reform that she was talking about or say that we don't need
Well, her specific call was for William White to resign. You know, he's a right. Rick Perry appointee, and he's actually been on the Finance Commission since 2004. Nobody really paid a whole lot of attention to him before until he made these ill-advised remarks. So, you know, as far as Abbott's relationship to White, well, I mean, Rick Perry appointed him. But she was trying to get him on the spot saying, you know, basically, do you agree that this gentleman who has a conflict of interest should step down? Also pointing out some campaign contributions, sizable campaign contributions that Greg Abbott received from the industry. Unfortunately for her, in the process of doing so, her campaign spokesperson got the numbers wrong, and so that became this kind of second-order story and diverted attention away from it. And the line from the Abbott camp was, she's not ready for prime time, and they're trying to sort of deflect attention away from what I think really is the policy issue that should interest the public, which is, should somebody who is an executive in a payday loan company oversee payday loan companies?
And you were saying that he kind of flew under the radar since his appointment in 2004. But what you wrote about this week was sort of what he's been up to, you know, while he's been wearing both these hats as both, you know, guy in Cash America and the head of the Finance Commission.
Yeah, and I guess I'm kind of naive. I like to leave some of the silly business around politics, you know, out of it for the moment, and trying to look, if he's the fox in the hen house, the question is, what has the fox been doing? And so, I've been collecting, you know, information over the past, you know, year or so, trying to get a handle on that, mainly through emails and internal documents at some of these state agencies. And what you could see is that one of the big things that the industry has been interested in is trying to stop cities from passing ordinances that regulate payday loans, because the state hasn't done anything.
Right.
So it's kind of gone to the cities. So, for example, when Austin was considering a payday loan ordinance, Mr. White told the chief regulator, the person who's kind of the day-to-day person, to tell Austin that they don't supersede state law, and then also sponsored a resolution that was passed by the Texas Finance Commission that basically said that the cities ought to be preempted, blocked by the state from implementing ordinances, and that later was used by the head of the Payday Loan Industry Association, the main one, to try to justify to the regulators that they had an interest in trying to step in front of what the cities were doing. Important to note that they were not successful with that. Every major city in the state of Texas, except for Fort Worth, now has ordinances regulating payday loans. But that was some of what the behind-the-scenes effort was.
So White, who works for Cash America, is also head of the Finance Commission, in that capacity says, you know, let's tell everyone that the cities don't supersede what happens at the state level.
Right.
And so that, you know, what he says there ends up getting pointed to by the industry, saying, look at what the state has to say about this.
That's right. And then the other part of this, and this isn't where he's directly involved, but some of his colleagues at Cash America were involved in working with regulators to help draft a bill at the legislative session in early 2013 that would have done precisely that, which is preempt the cities. And that was the number one item on the wish list for the payday loan people, because, you know, you take that away and there is no regulation. And I think, you know, there was definitely negotiations that went on, but that was their top priority. Let's block these meddling cities from messing with a good thing. And so you could see this nexus between Cash America, the regulators, all happening behind the scenes. And so that, I think, is just a little bit of a window into the fox in the hen house situation there.
Well, Forrest, thanks for sharing that story, and I'm looking forward to seeing the kerfuffle develop.
Indeed.
Kerfufflegate.
Kerfufflegate. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. Joining us now is Marie Shema, whose story, The Mystery of the San Antonio Four, appears in the January issue of the Texas Observer. Maurice, for those listeners who have perhaps not read your story yet, can you tell us about the San Antonio Four?
Sure. The San Antonio Four are four women from San Antonio who are now in their late 30s, but roughly 20 years ago in the early 90s, they were all accused of sort of really horrific child sex abuse. And it involved the nieces, the 7 and 9-year-old nieces of one of the women, Elizabeth Ramirez, who kind of emerges as the main character in the story. And, you know, what they were accused of doing was a sort of horrific, very ritualistic crime that calls to mind a lot of the satanic cases that some listeners might be familiar with. There were, you know, Fran and Dan Keller in Austin. There was, you know, daycare centers sort of around the country where adults were accused of molesting children in ways that involved, you know, rituals that, you know, invoked Satan and just sort of really bizarre acts that that nowadays sound really implausible and almost impossible, but at the time there was almost a hysteria about them. And this case came at the end of a lot of those, but for different interesting reasons, it hit San Antonio kind of at the end of the wave. And these four women all ended up in prison for it. And then sort of fast forward to 2006, there was a sort of a man in his mid-50s up in the Yukon Territory, a college instructor, and he discovered the case through various kind of research and really alone was the one who kind of beat the drum and tried to convince advocates and lawyers and journalists in Texas to take an interest in the case. And it took about 7 years of, you know, sort of the ball being passed from one person to another in terms of the work of this exoneration effort. And now the women are out and sort of looking forward, there's going to be a sort of a big legal battle over whether they're entitled to state money for their wrongful imprisonment. It's now pretty much agreed that they were wrongfully convicted, but there's still sort of wrangling over whether they're entitled to that money. So it's a really long case, sort of spanning 20 years or so. And the goal of the article was really to just kind of like put all these different puzzle pieces together and not, you know, sort of wash people over with an insane amount of information.
Right. There certainly are a lot of puzzle pieces. And the one that's the most curious for me by far is Daryl Otto, this professor that you mentioned. What's his deal?
He almost emerges like from a John Grisham novel or something. Yeah. He is a loner. I mean, he's lived up in Canada for years and years. He was married at one point, but long since divorced, and lives mostly with a bunch of huskies. He's from the eastern part of Canada, but just kind of went off the rails as a young man, drinking and hitchhiking and going all over the country. And when he kind of finally landed and settled down in his mid-20s, he got into biology. And he talked to me quite a bit in our interviews about his research on fish breeding. And I can't pretend that I really understood everything about it, but that was really his sort of research passion. But, you know, out there in the woods, you know, using a power generator to get the internet, he was really fascinated with crime. And I mean, I think that's one thing that makes him a little less mysterious is that, you know, true crime is like a genre of books is very popular. People do love reading about serial killers. And so he, in a lot of ways, I think, emerges from that kind of broader popular trend of reading about crime and weird, you know, acts that people, that seemingly normal people commit. And through that, I think he got particularly interested in the idea of sex offenders, who are sort of some of the most ostracized people really in our society. There's been some really good reporting in the Texas Observer about that, but, you know, we tend to think of sex offenders as the lowest of the low, just as a wider culture. And Daryl Otto was just really, I think, fascinated by that and eventually came across this case that in no way really fit with all of the things that he had read about sex offenders, that they were usually men, that when they were women, it was usually because it was like a teacher, you know, who had an eighth grade student or something that they had an affair with,
right.
That sort of thing. And this case just sort of made no sense, you know. Why would four women be accused of something so bizarre? So he started digging in and he sent letters to Elizabeth Ramirez, who was sort of the main woman. He found her on a website called writeaprisoner.net, which you can still visit and is a place for people who want a pen pal who's in prison. These letters went back and forth. When he first got a letter back from her, he was sort of stunned by the fact that this woman seemed to be very lucid and very articulate and wrote sort of at length about this bizarre, twisted story of how her, you know, sister had been married to a man and had two daughters with him, and he had had a love interest in her, and she rejected him,
right.
And she was also a lesbian, right? It gets twisted and bizarre, and Daryl didn't know what to make of it and didn't believe it. So he just kept sending her these letters to try to kind of iron it out, and eventually was convinced. And that's really where he becomes the primary advocate for these women.
So how did it come to be that such a twisted and bizarre tale was seen as plausible to the point at which these four women were evidently wrongly convicted? I mean, it wasn't that, and 20 years ago is not, you know, that long ago, really. I remember it. I remember 20 years ago.
I remember it.
It was the 90s.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So.
I think one part of it, and one part of what allowed it to happen in San Antonio was that it's a very, very conservative city, very Catholic, very evangelical Protestant. You know, there was, at that time, all four of these women who were all lesbians, you know, were regularly talked of, you know, being stared at on the street and having just sort of very negative reactions to their being out. And at that time, there were definitely more bizarre ideas about what gays and lesbians did in their spare time. I don't know that that explains it fully, but certainly when I imagine getting into the head of the jurors, this sort of general mystery around what gays and lesbians do fed into this a little bit, as did the fact that I think the girls, when they got on the stand, you know, you had these little kids who were traumatized, and there's a lot of theories that I kind of present in the article about why they were so traumatized, but I think that they, whether, you know, or not they believe themselves to be telling the truth as little kids, they were very believable to the jury. The one juror that I talked to really said that these little girls sold him on this story, as did their grandmother, who they had sort of initially reported the abuse to.
That's one thing that I was struck by reading your story, was just how much of it is still, I mean, we call it the mystery of the San Antonio Four, and there's still a lot of it that's just really unclear about where the story got started. And it seems like you're able to talk to so many folks that could have been the ones that kind of had a hand in, you know, planting the seeds of the story, and still there's not really any clarity on
really,
you know, why it got started in the first
from
place.
Not being able to
absolutely.
Get
I mean, I think when I first got started reporting the story, I, you know, read these accounts of Fabio Leone, who is the father of the girls, and many of their advocates believe coached the girls to make the accusations.
And not only,
you know, I think it was easy to dream of kind of an aha moment where I kind of cornered him in an interview and he would say, yes, of course, I coached my daughters.
I would have gotten away with it, too, if it weren't for the guy in the Yukon Territory.
Meddling man up there.
And his meddling dogs.
We were hoping that the model of care that we provide would drastically change.
There was only an idea that Javier was the one that was at the center of this, but
and we would have fewer patients.
The more I reported, the more I found that even the lawyers for the four women were not sort of super 100% about anyone's theory. There was some speculation that he was involved, but I was shocked when I first talked to one lawyer who was like, oh, no, there's no way Javier did it. I think it was the grandmother, you know. And I think I've come to feel that it's easy to say that it was definitely one person, but I can also imagine that they all believed that it happened and it just sort of quickly spun out of control. I've looked at some other stories that are not as bizarre as this one, but one that I published about in the Texas Observer a few months ago, where no one person was actively malicious. They all believed they were doing the right thing and that they had the right information, but small amounts of delusion on the part of many, many people just sort of added up into this larger situation that got really out of control.
The story you're talking about is the recanters, which you can read on texasobserver.org. That's a plug. And this reminds me of a question that I had for you, which is one of the girls, I believe it was Stephanie, decided to recant her testimony at what, 25? What mm-hmm. caused her to decide to recant?
What caused her to decide to recant?
Yeah.
When she publicly has said that she decided to recant because she wanted to make things right, but she finally realized that she had lied as a child and been coached to lie. So that's the version that she presents. The version that her father presents is that she maliciously recanted to get back at him because they had been fighting. And although that seems absurd to me at first glance, numerous people told me that they thought this woman was a little bit sort of off the handle in the sense that she had many, many times sort of abused people's trust and been kind of crazy. And so I don't necessarily think it's all one or all the other. But the idea that she had an ulterior motive that involved getting back at her father could still be true in addition to wanting to make things right, you know? I mean, it's all about what kind of moral compass you want to ascribe to her, and that's hard to do without being her, you know?
Yeah.
Now, going back to the San Antonio 4, bringing it up to the present day, earlier in the conversation you said they had been, you know, mostly or basically cleared, but they're no longer in prison, right? But what about a finding of actual innocence? Has that happened, and how do you get to that point where, you know, you've exhausted the process of undoing as much as possible the wrongful conviction?
What happens is that in the next few months, there will either be a hearing or a series of briefs exchanged between the prosecution and the defense about, when I say the prosecution, it's really the DA's office now, which for the most part is a different set of people than the DA's office that originally prosecuted the women. But the DA's office will have to sort of decide whether they're going to fully back the idea that the women are actually innocent. And if they do that, then it should be a relatively straightforward situation in which there's like they both present that to a judge in San Antonio, and the judge sends it up to the Court of Criminal Appeals in Texas, and that court has the final say. But if both the prosecution and the defense agree, and there's all this sort of media attention on the case, I mean, I would certainly, it's not good to predict, but I would certainly imagine it'll be a fairly clear sailing. If the DA's office, for one reason or another, decides that they don't think the women are necessarily innocent, and that would really come because the other daughter who accused them doesn't recant, then there could be a much more fraught battle in which there's a series of hearings and she's cross-examined by the defense.
What is it?
And it's really harder to imagine what that's going to look like, but it could stretch on much, much longer.
What does it mean for the women to have a finding of actual innocence? Anything in practical terms?
It means that the state has officially determined that they deserve full exoneration and that their names are sort of fully cleared for the crime, and that they would also be entitled to hundreds of thousands of dollars in, I believe that at this point Texas pays some amount of money, I think it's $80,000 per year that someone's wrongfully imprisoned, and they would be entitled to that money, and it would really transform their lives. If they're declared actually innocent, they could really stand to kind of gain quite a bit and really turn their life around in a very similar way to how, you know, Michael Morton has become the sort of major figure. That's really what that would mean.
Right.
Well, Maurice, thank you so much for sharing that story.
Yeah, thanks so much. Thanks.
You can read The Mystery of the San Antonio Four at texasobserver.org. And with that, we've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there for listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org, or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.